Packet Pushers.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Packet Protector, the podcast at the intersection of networking and security. I'm Jennifer JJ Vanilla, here with co-host Drew Conry Murray. And this week, we're untangling the big mess that is the MSSP offering, so managed security services like EDR and MDR and the managed MDR and SOC as a service. Remember, also, you guys can visit us and give your feedback anytime at packetpushers.net/FU. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to this on May 7th when we are at the RSA conference. So if you happen to be here, hit us up, come say hi. Otherwise, we'll talk to you next week. But first, Drew, let's look at a couple of the news headlines.
Yeah, JJ. So first, ByteDance, they own TikTok. They now have up to a year to divest their ownership in the social media app or be banned in the United States. That's because of a new law that U.S. President Joe Biden recently signed. If ByteDance doesn't divest in that time, the app would be banned from Apple and Google's app stores, and U.S. websites would be forbidden from hosting the application. I assume ByteDance is going to appeal this law in court, so we'll see what happens. I bring this up because there's been a lot of discussion about why this is happening. There's been issues around surveillance, data privacy, data collection, and risks of propaganda by the Chinese government, which doesn't officially control ByteDance, but we all know that it has influence over the platform. And I guess I just feel like I don't see banning the app or selling it to a U.S. company really solving those issues. I guess I feel like if the issue is actually data collection and data privacy, we need to pass better data privacy laws in the U.S. If the Chinese want info on American citizens, they can buy it from U.S. data brokers, or they can just hack into the data brokers and take it. And I'm looking at you, Equifax, when I say that. If the issue is propaganda and influence, Chinese state actors can still leverage American social media companies, not to mention traditional media. Russia did this successfully in the 2016 election. And if Americans still want to use the app, even if it's banned, they can just use a VPN. So I feel like it's not going to accomplish any of the goals it's setting out to do.
Yeah. Now, I think this is a big twisty one because I agree wholeheartedly, first and foremost, that we need better data privacy laws here in the U.S. I don't know why. Like toilets, we can't seem to get this right where the rest of the world has done a pretty good job, especially Europe.
That's a whole different combo, but yes.
They know how water closets and toilets should work, and we can't figure that out. Same thing with data privacy. I mean, joking aside, this is kind of a big deal because it's going to be an inflection point here in that U.S.-China political tension that's been mounting. And let's be real, the Chinese government blocks everything. They've been blocking everything. Yep. I mean, they block Facebook and Google and Twitter and YouTube and most of the online streaming, like, you know, Netflix. You cannot Netflix and chill when you're in China. Not possible.
I don't think you can really ever chill when you're in China.
Side note, Drew, I'm going to ask your opinion about this. Mm-hmm. I always thought Netflix and chill was like what you do, like especially girls who like to like drink their wine and have our dark chocolate and just sit around in our fuzzy slippers and watch TV and like binge watch something. Uh-huh. I thought that was Netflix and chill. I have recently been informed that Netflix and chill is a couple's activity.
Yes.
I'm going to leave it at that. Is that what it is? It's a couple's activity?
That's what I heard too. I initially assumed it also meant the same thing. You're just relaxing. But yes, I believe it does for the people of a different generation have different connotations.
Yeah. Okay. So listeners, if at any point during the podcast recordings in the past few weeks, I've talked about Netflix and chill, I was just meaning watching TV. Okay. But back to China. The Great Firewall of China, they block everything. They mm-hmm. especially block U.S. social media. So, you know, there's a few different things here. We need to do better with data privacy. What we do or don't do here will impact our relationship with China, but I don't know that it's really going to make any difference. What else are they going to do? They're going to retaliate by blocking what? I mean, they're already block everything. They're already banning any chip manufacturers, right? Processing manufacturers
yep.
that are not Chinese. So this is a trend that's been going on for, you know, 15 years at this point. I don't think it's going to stop. I don't think it matters from the Chinese side. I'm not worried about retaliation from that.
Right.
I do understand. I don't use TikTok, you know, working with a DOD contractor for many years. Snapchat and TikTok are not in my social media repertoire. Mm-hmm. But I do know that a lot of people, a lot of influencers, people use it for advertising. They use it for sharing. And I do hope they, you know, reach some agreement here. And probably that's going to be a sale because, like you said, you know, even if they're saying they're not selling data to the Chinese government, that the Chinese government is not like here. The Chinese government has a stake. The Communist Party has a stake in, with, and through every entity in China. And just by virtue of watching it from the outside and seeing all of the sanctions that they have. I hope that's evident to people. And, you know, they're trying to twist this around back on us. You know, it's like when you're a kid and somebody gives you a little insult and then they're like, well, I know you are, but what am I? Like, that's China right now. So it's all just kind of noise, but it will be interesting to see what happens here, because this being a U.S. side sanction and blocking something coming in, that is unusual, right? That's new for us. So I'm curious to see what happens.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a whole legal fight before we even get into, you know, sort of the repercussions of the nation state tech battle that's going on between the U.S. and China. And I also just want to make clear, do I believe that the Chinese government does and would use TikTok for data harvesting, for surveillance, and for propaganda purposes? Absolutely, 100%. The thing is, I think we have a broader problem of misinformation and propaganda and lies being spread in the United States by U.S. actors on U.S.-controlled platforms. So banning TikTok doesn't really address the fundamental problems we have here in the U.S. with social media companies around data collection, surveillance, and the spread of misinformation. So the whole thing to me around TikTok feels like, okay, maybe we'll get some arsenic out of the water, but we are ignoring all the cyanide gushing in. It doesn't feel like it's a real solution to our actual problems.
Same thing with the U.S. government, right? People were all up in arms because the U.S. government was legally with an L, legally purchasing data on U.S. citizens from the various outlets that data is available, right? Because we willingly sign away our soul when we use these apps on our phone. You know, they know everything about us. They physically track us, logically track us, geographically track us. And the same thing could certainly happen here. They could still purchase that data from somewhere else back to hashtag better privacy rules.
Sure. Or just walk up with a subpoena or a FISA court order.
Yeah. Speaking of data privacy laws and data collection, I think, Drew, you sent me down a rabbit hole with this one that I'm still crawling around through. And it sounds like you got a little up in arms. Talk to us about General Motors.
Yeah. So the New York Times has a really infuriating story of how General Motors has been collecting driver data and selling it to insurance companies without driver knowledge or consent. That data includes things like number of trips taken, start and stop times, length of time per trip, and hard braking or accelerations during those trips. The story says some drivers have seen their insurance premiums go up because of this data collection. The story also notes that GM mandates its car dealers activate the tracking service when they sell a car to a customer, even if the customer doesn't want it or doesn't actually know about it. It's again, this whole issue of data surveillance and a lack of good privacy laws here in the U.S. And I guess this is of particular interest to you, JJ, because you own a GM car.
I do. I saw this and I just kind of went,
what?
And it stopped everything that I was doing. I have a Cadillac. I've been driving Cadillacs for many, many years. That's no secret. I love them. So I logged into my app and it does indicate that I am not enrolled in the Smart Driver program. And I do most certainly remember opting out of that at some point. Mm-hmm. However, I think in the link that you shared and the links that'll be in the show notes here, one of the reporters that dug pretty deeply into this and was impacted by it found that their app showed them not enrolled. But when they went to the website, then they were enrolled. And GM just said, oh, there was some bug there.
Oops, it was a mistake.
The rabbit hole I'm down right now, of course, we paused to come record this, was, you know, can I find this setting on the website to make sure it's in alignment with my app? That setting seems to have been removed, at least from all of their help files. It's not where they've indicated it. But I know it sounds innocuous. Oh, okay. Well, they know your driving habits. But one of the people that they interviewed in this article that you posted was, he drives his CTS-V, which is a sporty little speedy Cadillac with, like, I don't know, a 12-cylinder, an 8-turbo. It is snappy. Mm-hmm. The dealership gave me one temporarily when I was having some work done on one of my vehicles. And I quickly decided that the best thing I could do with that car is park it and not drive it anywhere unless I liked blue lights behind me. So he drives it on a racetrack, right? Because they have the dates where certain racetracks are open, you can take your cars. Uh-huh. And I think they said his insurance, because what they're doing is this is getting fed into two data broker houses. The insurance companies for car insurance are subscribing to that data. Mm-hmm. And this person's insurance went up like $5,000 a month or $5,000 a period, whatever that period was, which is completely ludicrous because they don't even know who's driving the car when they pull that data from it. And so this was very blatant in my mind as a security and privacy professional looking at this. There are several issues in this chain from the dealership. So this person that wrote the article Drew's going to give for you guys went back to the dealership that they had just purchased this vehicle from and asked that salesperson to talk them through the signup process. Mm-hmm. They're trying to figure out how they got opted in.
Right.
And so there were just a series of issues of the people at the dealerships opting them into things that were clearly labeled.
Customer should consent. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to have to give consent, et cetera, yeah, et cetera. And then to not be able to actually see the status of it on your own app, there's a chain of like It's not one little boo-boo here. There's just a chain of several things. Even if you had read that information, that screen at the dealership, right? It was not clear on what they were doing with the information.
Yeah.
Certainly, I wouldn't have expected them to be selling it to insurance companies. So I'm with you, Drew. This chapped my chippers a little bit here.
Yeah. So I should note the article says that last month, GM stopped sharing data with LexisNexis and Verisk, and the company also hired a new chief trust and privacy officer.
I bet they did.
Not sure if this is still going on. If you own a GM vehicle, may want to double check those settings. And also, if you do own a GM vehicle, go yell at your dealer about this. All right, last news story before we move on to the main topic. Several episodes ago, we discussed a vulnerability with a critical rating of 10 out of 10. It affected some software versions of Palo Alto Networks PAN-OS. The vulnerability affected its Global Protect Secure Remote Access feature in PAN-OS. The company has written a blog post with more details about the vulnerability. I just wanted to call that out if you're interested in finding out what all the hoopla was and what was going on and how they addressed it. We'll have those links in the show notes. All right, so let's dive into unpacking what we mean when we say managed security service providers or managed security services. It's more complicated than you think.
This is one of the questions, I think. So in the consulting with various clients, including a lot of them at IONS on the research side, one of the questions we see a lot is someone is trying to choose a partner in managing to some degree part of the security workflow, right? Mm-hmm. Drew, if you're good, I'm going to dive in on a couple of things here and then let's just kind of have a conversation about what you've seen in your perception of these or where things might be confusing or good questions here. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about MSSP, which is managed security services, as opposed to MSP, which is just managed service partners. And I think right in here is kind of like the crux of where we went off a couple of different paths. So you do have some managed service partners that added security offerings to what they were already doing. And I think this was sort of the genesis or the birth of MSSP. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you had a managed service partner back in the day, you know, it might have been somebody was kind of managing your Windows environment for you, managing the endpoints or the stuff on the endpoint, or maybe they were managing, you know, your Windows server and your Active Directory for you and doing some updates. We weren't necessarily considering it patching at the time, but keeping things up to date, maybe, you know, getting antivirus on there and managing that. And then they started adding security services on top of that. And so these were typically organizations that already had some type of persistent access into your environment to manage it. Uh-huh. Maybe they're doing help desk too. And so there's this sort of pedigree of MSSP where there's a solution provider that was in there doing other stuff. And then now they're just sort of adding security services on top of that.
So I guess the issue then is, do you want someone who's doing regular managed services and security on top, or is security enough of an issue by itself that you want to go with maybe an organization that's actually just what they specialize in, the MSSP, the managed security services provider or partner?
Well, and I think that's where we'll kind of get to a little bit of that, because it's going to depend. I hate that we always in IT talk about it depends, but it's true.
Yeah.
The benefit here is your managed service provider already has some connection or some relationship and knowledge of your environment, at least to some degree. So adding one more thing to it, if it's, oh, you know what, we would really just like you to patch things for us, right? When security patches come out. On top of that, why reinvent the wheel and manage two partners and two vendors for that? And that's a pretty easy lift. Now, we can kind of talk about, you know, what the activity set or workflow is in the security realm of like what a security analyst does in a SOC. So I'll hit on that in just a second. That's where the roads start to diverge a little bit, right? In capabilities and tools.
Yeah.
But the other pedigree of MSSPs are the ones that came from, I'm going to call them product or solution sets. So this is your endpoint security vendors, your antivirus vendors, your SIEM, which is like security event correlation vendors, all of these different vendors that have a security product or offering that are then offering it as a managed or a hosted solution. And that's really a different pedigree of company and a different pedigree of the service offering. So some of the services that they might do, regardless of where they came from, right? We talked about patching. They might be monitoring some or all of the environment and handling the alerting and response, which we'll talk about in a second with MDR. And then we've got things like vulnerability scanning and vulnerability management, which is a little bit of a subtle difference there. And then I think to further complicate that is I've kind of been intertwining the word managed with other things. We've got, you know, managed services, managed security. We've got managed detection and response in the way of MDR. And I've talked about as a service as well. I break this into three buckets.
Okay.
The hard part is that the three buckets don't have clear lines between them.
The three buckets are also connected.
Yeah, it's three terminology buckets. And when one fills up to it, it's like those weird little mind games where you, which section of this fills up first, the little games you see online. So there's the word managed, which might be in front of something, right? Mm-hmm. Managed XDR, managed detection and risk, blah, blah, blah. And then there is something that's like as a service. We talk about software as a service.
Infrastructure as a service, et cetera, yeah.
Which has a lot of overlap with things that are just cloud hosted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, SaaS applications are, their software as a service, but it's specifically a cloud hosted service being offered.
Yeah, that's where it can get tricky because software as a service, infrastructure as a service, there is an element of this offering that is managed for me, but it's not necessarily what we think of when we mean a managed service.
So we'll talk about that too, if we have time, maybe just like how touchy these things are, how deep they are in the touch. But just know that one vendor might call something a managed something and another might call it as a service. And that there's not necessarily parity between a managed X and a managed Y, or X as a service and Y as a service. They can mean different things. Mm-hmm. So as a service might just mean that it's hosted, but it could also be that there is a, to confuse issues more, a service as a service. Which is different than a product as a service. This is a good way to think about it, right? Because software as a service is software that's just hosted for you.
Right.
But if you take a service as a service, like a full SOC, a security operations center, which is kind of like a whole suite of services, and you're talking about delivering that as a service, that is actually a service as a service as opposed to a subscription to something.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Clear
okay.
as mud, I'm sure.
I think I follow that. I guess SOC maybe is a good place to start. What are the activities that I would expect to get out of a SOC as a service?
So in a security operations center, you've got different groups of people and different tiers of people with different skill sets. There's a handful of things that they're typically doing in a SOC, and that would normally start with vulnerability management. Uh-huh. And here I've specifically used the word vulnerability management instead of, you know, scanning. But that is everything in the life cycle of vulnerabilities. That's detecting vulnerabilities. That's pretty easy because you run scanners for that typically. Prioritizing the vulnerabilities is a little harder because anytime you scan an environment, you're going to come back with, you know, pages, dozens of hundreds of pages of vulnerabilities. And then it's a matter of contextualizing that enough to figure out where to spend your attention. Because if you come back and you've got, let's say your environment has 1,000 endpoints and 40 servers and networking stuff. Some of it is external facing, some of it is internal facing. You're going to come back with, on any given Thursday, thousands of vulnerabilities possibly.
Yeah.
But not all of them are in context because, you know, something that can only be exploited in certain circumstances or in combinations with other things, and that thing is not internet facing. Maybe it's even air gap to some degree. So prioritizing the vulnerability is part of that life cycle, and then remediating it, like, you know, patching it or doing whatever you need to do to make sure that thing is secure. So vulnerability management is the first thing, and that's a string of activities. The second is everything related to monitoring. And that's really monitoring for signatures for things that are malicious or indicators of compromise or anomalous behavior, whatever you have the tools for. It's monitoring for those types of things. And then sort of the chain of activities that go along with that is correlating the different monitoring events to understand what constitutes an incident. So for example, if you're monitoring and suddenly there are a bunch of failed logins on an endpoint and then a server application, and then you see a large amount of data going out a path that it doesn't normally egress from a source and destination. Like suddenly there's a large amount of traffic seen from some application or storage to a public drop cloud account.
Yep.
So that's the monitoring and then the correlation of that. Again, these are like several strings of activities that go along with it. Then that puts you into the third bucket, which is incident management. So now you think something's happening. What do you do with that? And that's, you know, there's an alerting, there's an evaluation process to vet it and see, is this normal or expected? Is it weird? What's our level of confidence? Let's escalate. And then if it is an incident, what is our response for that?
Right.
So those are kind of like the bread and butter of a SOC right there. That's bare minimum.
Yep.
And then there's things other people might be doing in a more robust SOC if they have the resources for this, which is like you see references to threat hunting. Those are people that are going out and proactively looking for things on the network or within the assets versus waiting for something to happen.
So how would you distinguish threat hunting from monitoring?
This is one of those cases where there are vendors that kind of use those interchangeably. But I think a pure incident response person is going to describe it as threat hunting is going out and finding vulnerabilities or groups of configurations that might pose a vulnerability or sort of the unknown unknowns instead of the known unknowns to find an issue before an attacker does. Mm-hmm. Or to find an issue that might be an attack before a tool does. So think of like 0 days, right? Mm-hmm. It's a far more advanced person doing that type of analysis.
And it sounds in some ways more active than monitoring, which could be sort of categorized as a passive event. You're just getting signals and sending them somewhere. Whereas with your description of threat hunting, I'm looking at configurations. I'm looking at the systems that are on this company's premises and identifying vulnerabilities and how those vulnerabilities might be combined to become an exploit, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. The threat hunting is going to tend to be more proactive. Mm-hmm.
So if I'm thinking about SOC as a service, I assume it's because, one, I may not have the expertise or the equipment on site to do it myself.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first, let's take the threat hunting and, you know, like forensics and stuff out of it for a second. And those first, the vulnerability management, the monitoring, and the incident management. Mm-hmm. Each of those takes a set of skills. Like, so you've got headcount, you know, butts in seats and people actually watching the alerts, right?
Right.
You've got the skill sets that they have to have in the training and expertise in both the technology as well as the platforms being used. There are platforms and software tooling used for each of these. And for every one of those, pretty much there's a set of those. So it's not like one person using one tool. You know, I kind of gave the example of vulnerability management where there's scanning for vulnerabilities, there's contextualizing the vulnerabilities, there's prioritizing the vulnerabilities, and then there's remediation plans. Because outside of a small org, if you detect vulnerabilities in Chromebooks, Apple tablets, Windows laptops, some servers here, some servers up in the cloud, some of the networking equipment, right? Switches, routers, et cetera. The same people probably aren't patching and addressing vulnerabilities, and the same person isn't dealing with all of those. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's whole frameworks and tool sets for just vulnerability management.
Right. Just a brief pause to ask, did you know Packet Pushers has a job board? Whether you're looking to find or fill your next great IT infrastructure role, the Packet Pushers job board is the place to go. It's easy to post, easy to browse, and easy to apply. So whether you've got IT talent or you're looking for IT talent, visit jobs.packetpushers.net and get to work. That's jobs.packetpushers.net.
So back to your question of what does that look like for outsourcing it? And I think this is where the managed, the as a service. So let's say it's a hosted SOC. That's probably going to be like a hosted SIM. So they're giving you a platform to send logs, mm-hmm. and they're giving you a platform for event correlation. So instead of you having that tool application platform in-house, they're hosting it for you, and maybe they're managing pieces of the back end for you, or it could be SIM as a service. So they're not replacing your security analyst. They're just giving you a spot in the cloud to put the software.
Okay, so they're handling the data collection and the backend stuff to make sure I've got enough storage and memory and compute power. Yeah.
But if it's a fully managed SOC, and some places do call this SOC as a service, because now we're back into that, you know, some type of service is mm-hmm. a service instead of a product, that could be that it's fully managed. And so your partner in this then is handling all of those aspects. They're doing the vulnerability management, they're doing the monitoring and alerting. And they're also who's taking lead on incident response and incident management.
Okay.
And then you've got subsets of that, right? A lot of the things we're talking about with like managed EDR or managed XDR, certain MDR are going to do pieces of this for pieces of different parts of your network.
So it seems like maybe a good way to try to parse this out is you've got notes in here on the level of touch, meaning how much interaction am I going to have with the provider, be it as a service or a managed service or whatever. Maybe we should run through those because I think that's a useful way to distinguish the different kinds of services I'm going to get.
I would describe the levels of touch, if we're doing this sort of subjectively here, like, you know, low, medium, high, mm-hmm. a no level of touch would be you buy a product and then you're managing it yourself.
Okay.
So nobody else is doing anything for you. I would bump that up to the next level being a hosted only solution. So this is like kind of minimal, where you're buying a license or a subscription for some type of hosted platform. And now we're in this like SaaS, right? Some type of software or tool as a service. And you are responsible for managing the workings of the software itself using the tool. Like you described a minute ago, like they're going to make sure it has a place to live in the cloud.
Okay.
They'll make sure it's scalable, you know, whatever. but they're just hosting a platform. They're not doing anything for you.
So sticking with that Seam example, hosted only, the Seam is running somewhere in a cloud or a colo somewhere. I send all my data and logs to it. It's up to the hoster to make sure it's got all the infrastructure it needs, but it's up to me to be in that console every day, writing my rules, running my queries, looking at everything that I'm sending to that Seam.
Exactly.
Okay. And then next you've got the light touch.
Yeah. Again, totally is like relative and subjective here. So I would say that there's light, medium, and full. So light is your partner or provider is going to have some type of responsibility into the actual operations of that product or solution or the tool set. So they're not responsible for the whole workflow that I described from a SOC, but they're going to do a piece of it. Medium, maybe they're getting a little more of responsibility into the operations. Maybe they're co-managing the solution with you. You play some role, they're responsible for a larger piece of the pie. And that could be more of the protect surface or more of the environment, or it could mean a deeper responsibility for a subset of the devices.
It is an example for medium. If let's use IPS as an example, I get 1,000 alerts a day in a medium support environment. They would go through that and tell me the 5 or 10 that I should really be paying attention to. But again, it's up to me to do something about the 5 or 10, but they've helped me sift through that 1,000 to find the ones that mean something to me.
Yep. So that would be vertically oriented into, I think you picked IPS. So an intrusion prevention system running on whatever it's running on, firewall or something else. Yes. It could also be a managed SIM where they are downscoping or pre-filtering. They're acting as like the first tier.
Okay.
Across on-prem network and your Microsoft cloud environment. This is where things get a little messy because it could be one type of asset or part of the network, or it could be the whole, I'm air quoting, whole network as much as that's possible. And then a fully managed provider is basically going to do it for you. And that doesn't absolve you of any responsibility or role to play, but they're going to do a more soup to nuts kind of white glove turnkey thing where they're managing the tools. They are responsible for that life cycle of whatever they're offering in that service set. They are doing that whole piece of it and interacting with you only at the point that they can't anymore.
Okay.
Because, I mean, legally, there's going to be certain things they can't do, right?
Yeah. How far does that end, though? Can they trigger a firewall or IPS rule to block an attack as they see it happening? Can they go in and shut down an application? Is that something that you negotiate with them in the contract?
Yep. It absolutely is. And that can happen different ways. So some of these providers, they plug into the infrastructure. I've been nebulously using like infrastructure, network environment endpoints. But, you know, some of them, if you kind of think about everything you care about in your enterprise network, you've got endpoints, you've got servers and workloads, and those are, they might be on-prem, they might be in the cloud or both. You've got your users, you've got identity providers, you know, whether it's Google, Microsoft 365, Entra ID, Okta, whatever, cloud infrastructure. So outside of like Microsoft 365 and Entra, if you're actually running, you know, servers and workloads in Azure or AWS, all of your on-prem stuff where they've got visibility into switches, routers, firewalls, wireless, the different solutions, they all sound alike when you look at their marketing junk. But the truth is they're connecting into these, what we define as, you know, protect surfaces or assets, and they have different levels of visibility into different types of assets. And this is where the pedigree of the solution comes into play, because an endpoint security and an EDR and AV vendor is obviously going to be heavier visibility on an endpoint or a server running an operating system versus some of the other solutions, you know, like Palo or Cisco or whoever might have a little more pedigree and context coming from, you know, on-prem infrastructures. Obviously, they have cloud offerings too, but your Symantec isn't going to be alerting you on your switching infrastructure. So kind of understanding what they're looking at and then how they're plugged in from a monitoring standpoint and how they're plugged in from an enforcement standpoint. So you're asking about remediation. Like, we have options. If the provider has some type of connection into the endpoint, they can do different things. They can manage the actual endpoint firewall. So if it's Windows firewall, they could make changes into Windows firewall. They can manipulate the network interface card to actually like fully quarantine and shut off all access. Let's say ransomware or malware is discovered on an endpoint. They would have to get legal authorization ahead of time to do this. And you could do it for groups of assets or devices. But let's say that we scope out and we say, all right, in our 1,000 endpoints, let's just pretend if any of them gets hit with ransomware or any type of malware that could spread, we want to immediately auto-quarantine that device.
Okay.
These vendors, depending on where they came from and the hooks they have into the operating system, will usually offer at least one way to do it, possibly as many as three or four to auto quarantine.
Okay. I've contracted them ahead of time that, you know, under these conditions, you have permission to take this endpoint off my network.
Yep. And I think that's a critical piece because I've definitely sat on some phone calls with unhappy companies because they deployed a managed, you know, security solution with their provider, but they didn't get all the way through onboarding. So they didn't deploy, you know, whatever agents or APIs or connections throughout the entire organization, or they did, but then they didn't ever go back around and give that partner authorization for automated actions. Let me also like kind of tease out this nuance because I just said automated actions.
Yeah.
If it's a fully outsourced SOC, I don't mean an automated action like, oh, this tool thinks there's an issue or malware, therefore immediately quarantine something. Mm-hmm. A good SOC is going to have teams, rooms full of people that are working 24/7, and it will immediately go for human verification.
Okay. So automated action sounds more like sort of an internal playbook is going to run and a human's going to be pulled in to decide, do we pull the trigger on this and knock the device off the network?
Yeah. I use the example with ransomware. That might be the one exception where we just say, look, it's worth it to potentially knock an endpoint off if we think there's ransomware before it spreads. Mm-hmm. But it could be that other indications of compromise or breach might be you want human validation before any action's taken.
So an endpoint running a Nessus scan, you'd be like, let's get a human in there, but probably we're going to take this off the network as opposed to this is ransomware, just have the machine automatically do it.
Yep, exactly.
I'm assuming in these levels of touch, none through full, there is going to be different pricing tiers associated with this.
You would think so. This is where, I mean, I get frustrated watching this because, you know, having worked with so many customers over the years through so many of these solutions and selling and integrating some of them myself, there are so many companies out there who will offer a managed security something or other. And they are like doing the most basic monitoring on a subset of devices with limited visibility and no human intervention, or they just literally throw alerts over the fence.
Right.
And some of them charge a premium for that. I didn't have any role in this. The customer that I was working with had selected a provider. I don't even think they were fully onboarded, but all they were doing is they were charging a lot of money. They had a rule set up. And so when certain things happened, they basically triggered an email and that was it.
You can get that for free.
Yeah. Versus some of the other managed detection and response partners I've worked with who, you know, really do run a full SOC and they are doing the same steps your employees would be doing if you had a SOC in the house. And then at the point where they get to, okay, you need to do something or participate in this with us, they pick up the phone and they call you and they have an escalation, right? We go through this every quarter when they're SOC certified, you do this, you revalidate. Okay. If something happens, this person and this phone number is my first phone call. If I don't get them, this is my second phone call. This is my third, da, 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 da. These are the first emails I send. These are the second tier of emails they send. And they will keep calling until they get somebody at your company.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to ask about, particularly at the SOC example, SOC as a service. My assumption is that these SOC as a service companies don't have infinite resources. So the SOC engineers working for me, they've also got essentially other clients they're working with. So am I getting a shared resource here or can I get a team that's just dedicated to me 24/7.
That depends on the provider. So again, I think there's kind of the whole spectrum here. And this is one of the things that's really hard to tell from even beyond marketing. It's hard to tell even a conversation because anybody trying to sell you their service is going to promise you the world and talk to you about their 24/7 SOC operations and their huge team. I always ask about things like, you know, turnover. What is the staffing ratio of customers? So the shorter answer to that then is if you are a small environment, you are definitely going to have shared resources. But again, with some of the partners, I'll just throw out, because I'm familiar with them, like Arctic Wolf, they assign you a concierge team. And some other companies do too, where you have your two or three people who know your environment. When you onboard, they go over your network diagrams with you. They help you. They know you. They know your users. They know your environment. Uh-huh. But they are not the two people sitting there 24/7. They have regular hours, but they are backed by a team that is there 24/7. The smaller your company is, the more shared those assets are going to be. And these companies rely on really good, you know, machine learning and tuning in their tool sets for them to parse that down or filter down the noise to get to the good stuff. But if you're a larger customer, you can definitely negotiate dedicated resources. And I've done that for clients before.
So I could put in my contract, essentially, if something goes down, I want to get JJ on the phone.
Well, not with me, but...
No, not you, but...
with a partner. Yeah. And I mean, remember, you can have a team, but you need people on rotation, right? If you want 24/7, you want fresh eyes, arms, legs, right? At the keyboard, but they would staff that for you appropriately. So if it's 9 to 5, maybe you get JJ. If it's after hours, maybe you get Sam or Anita, but they would rotate through like that.
Okay. But I do get somebody who is familiar with my environment, sort of familiar with my risk profile, familiar with what's critical to my business, that kind of thing.
You can absolutely work that out. Of course, that gets more expensive, but it's worth it.
Anytime you say concierge, you can expect to pay more. So maybe wrapping up then, just sort of general questions and considerations that folks should have in mind if they're thinking about getting into the tangle of MSSPs or as a service security.
Well, the first thing I'll say is that I do think, especially with the threats we're dealing with right now, for a lot of companies, I mean, the majority of companies, having a partner who you can outsource some of this to is a fantastic model. I've done full ROIs, like a return on investment and costing analysis for what it would take. So just as, you know, a point of reference here, when we talk about this, if you want to run a 24/7 operation with just bare bones SOC functionality, you're talking about bare minimum squeaking by and not doing a great job, 7 to 8 full-time people.
Wow. Okay.
Plus the tools. Mm-hmm. And that is really squeaking by, and that's not going to be a large organization. And so for a smaller mid-sized organization, that is very expensive. That's the sort of baseline we're working with when we talk about looking for partners. And then it's, okay, well, what resources do we have? And that tends to be where I start, is like with a customer, what teams do you have? What resources? Who do you have access to? At what frequency? How much of their day can you get them? And then what kind of tools do you have, or can you get easily? I'm not a huge fan of running a bunch of open source tools if you don't have the people who can deploy them and maintain them. Uh-huh. Because the beauty about off-the-shelf software is you've got some throats to choke. You're paying somebody some money, you can get squeaky or you can go somewhere else, right? Uh-huh. What do you have to work with to start with? Because that informs how much of this do we need to outsource? And then it's a matter of kind of prioritizing what those risks are. So without, you know, keeping this short, I would go through an exercise to look at where are our biggest gaps and where are we bleeding here, and make sure that that is addressed first, because it's easy to get dazzled with like all of the shiny things in the security service space. But the truth is, there's a handful of things that just need to be done regularly and well and thoroughly, and the rest of the stuff is icing on the cake. So then I would say, based on whatever that gap analysis is, what do we need the partner to have visibility into? Are we heavily on campus? Do we have a lot of, you know, healthcare, IoT or OT, ICS type stuff? Uh-huh. And really the network is our primary concern. Uh-huh. Probably not in all organizations, right? We also have endpoints and users walking around out in the world connecting to God knows what. So I would kind of understand, what are those different assets that we care about or that we have the biggest gap with in our own tool set? So these things can manage and monitor everything from all of your networky things to the endpoints, the servers, but also your cloud infrastructure. So they'll have APIs they can hook into Google or Microsoft or whatever. And then if I'm expecting them to do stuff for me, I want to understand what they do and how they do it and with what frequency. So if patching is part of their strategy, then I would want to understand that in the context of the vulnerability management. How are they scanning for patches? What are they scanning? How are they prioritizing that? Because if they don't know your environment, that's going to tell you how familiar they're going to get with your environment. Because somebody on that low touch side is going to go, oh, well, we run a whatever Nessus scanner. We address any of the tens.
Yeah.
And that sounds great, except for it's not contextualized for your environment. So a more mature organization with a SOC provider with a fuller service is going to say, you're going to contextualize the endpoints, the users, and the servers for us. And we need to understand which ones are public facing, which ones are critical to your business. You can label them. And then we're going to prioritize the vulnerability management based on that. They're both valid answers, but one is going to indicate to you how involved that provider is with your network. And then I want to know what they're going to do. So whether they're managing and monitoring the network side or the endpoints or the cloud, when they think they've seen something weird, what do they do and how they do it? So I described a minute ago that escalation path of a human picking up the phone after validation and starting a call chain, which is very different than, well, if this tool picks something up, we send you an email and then they're done. Perhaps the email model works for you if you have the other assets or resources, but probably if you have the resources in-house to manage that, you should just be managing the tools and tuning your own alerting.
Right. Maybe one thing is to ask them, how do they define an incident? Because that can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. And it might mean something different in your mind than it does in the provider's mind.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, if they're following any type of security framework, like, you know, any of the NIST 800 series or CSF, that is part of doing that in a framework that the organization will define what constitutes an incident. But in the absence of that, because a lot of smaller organizations that need a partner for these services, they don't have that well defined, which is why they need partners for things. And, you know, typically then the pieces that are built in, the standard templates that these companies are using are usually a great starting point, and then you just tweak them. And I think tweaking and tuning is important. And that would be probably one of my questions is, how do we adjust what we're doing for our environment? In a larger environment, there's a lot of things that would be considered noise and we would tune out. And in a smaller environment, we would want to see a lot more things, right? Like if somebody gets added to an admin group, like a root privilege kind of group, in a small environment, I want to know that. In a large environment, that's just noise.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And that's okay. Not contextualized. Context matters.
Yeah. Do I want to ask them about their staffing levels, the kind of tools they use, SOC locations, that kind of thing? Does that matter?
I would. Yeah. Because this is effectively an extension of your team. And so to understand who they have, where they have them, if your own company has compliance requirements, you might have some restrictions as to where those data centers are located. But that's also going to help indicate when you start asking, you know, I mentioned a minute ago, like turnover and things like that. How well are they able to retain? Because that tells you a lot about any company.
Sure.
Right? When you walk into your favorite restaurant and the staff there is turned over every few months and they're not keeping them, like something's amiss. And it's the same thing with the security provider. They're not being treated well, or something is broken, right? Or there's a process that's broken and it's frustrating for them. So, you know, turnover, what staff, what tools. And can you have access to the tools or the logs? Can you at least see the logs if you want to get to the raw logs? Where are they located? And then the teams, you know, what is that ratio? And this is one of those weird sliding scales, because I'm not going to say a higher security analyst to customer environment ratio is better, because that all has to be taken in context too. Because if they have really good tooling and they have really good tuning, one team, because it's not just one person, you know, one team of SOC analysts can handle a lot of, let's say, small, medium environments, because they're only having to filter out, the tools have filtered for them until it requires some human validation or intervention. So if somebody says, okay, well, each, you know, SOC team or whatever handles 200 environments versus 20, the 20 isn't necessarily better. The 200 might be very, very well tuned, and that organization's getting a lot more data sets, more data, better machine learning, and better automation.
Can be, if it's set up well, yeah.
Yes. That's a good point. Yeah, it can be.
All right, well, I hope we've not just confused you more by trying to untangle all of the as-a-service security service providers, but given you some useful information you can take with you as you investigate this space. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Packet Protector. You can find us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you want more nerdy goodness on networking, on wireless, cloud, network automation, and more, go to packetpushers.net. You'll find thousands of hours of free technical content for your listening pleasure. You can also find JJ and I on LinkedIn, and you can interact with us on the Packet Pushers Slack channel. We've got a Slack channel dedicated to Packet Protector. There's also a general channel if you just want to hang out, have a laugh, ask questions, share some memes, do whatever. The community on Slack is a lot of fun. So come on over and join us. That's all at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.